We are running a little bit late here at 11:07. I would like to start. And I just want to thank everybody so much for dialing in for the Amherst Pierrepoint year ahead call. And I would first like to start with Steve Abrams, who's our head of strategy. I'm going to give you the outlook for the year ahead. Without any ado, Steve, why don't you go ahead?
All right. Thanks so much, Siobhan. And good morning, good afternoon, everyone. So I just wanted to offer a few thoughts on some of the market macro overlays that kind of sit on top of some of the issues I'm sure Siobhan will talk about in her EM outlook. But the important thing is that as we go from 2021 into 22, we're really moving from a regime where central banks around the world have been steadily pumping money into the equation and taking a very strong hand in managing substantial parts of the market, into a regime where central banks are going to start pulling back some of their support and private capital is going to start having a little bit more market power. So the most obvious, in some ways, conclusion you can draw from that is that we're going to see much more volatility in 2022 than we saw in 2021. And the surprising thing is, if you look at markets that are pricing the volatility that sits in front of us, and probably the easiest place is to look at the interest rate options market, the market is really not priced for that. In general, the options market, the implied volatility in the options market, actually declines from where we are now, notwithstanding the recent rise in volatility. So the market's expecting volatility to slowly diminish, but in all likelihood, we're in for a year of rising volatility and possibly volatility that will persist beyond just 2022. Let me make a couple of more detailed points on that. So for one thing, a lot has changed since the last time, certainly the Fed tapered. Obviously, the Fed really tapered only once before, and the bulk of that was over the course of 2014. And probably the most important thing that has changed is actually the Fed itself. Its policy, its reaction function has changed. In August of 2020 at Jackson Hole, the Fed laid out a new framework for thinking about inflation, its flexible average inflation targeting, which allows inflation to run well above target over certain periods of time so that on average, inflation is at the Fed's preferred target. And we're kind of living right now with some of the more immediate results. I mean, core PCE in the U.S. From 2008 through 2020 was really only above 2% twice and very briefly. But yet here we are with core PCE above 3.5. And as I think you'll hear from Stephen Stanley later, reasonable expectations that it's going to remain high. In fact, the inflation markets are expecting inflation to run in the 3% or higher neighborhood over the course of at least the next 2 years. The economy has also changed. We are now, I guess, in a pandemic economy, although that continues to evolve. So the mix of contributors to GDP have changed a little bit. But we're also looking at an economy, an international economy, where international trade volumes, supply lines have started to change and have started to become restructured. Now, that's a trend that started before the pandemic, but nevertheless is important. And we have risk from the pandemic itself. The whole episode that we're still, to some degree, in the middle of around Omicron tells us that the pandemic leaves us with a long tail of COVID-19 variants ahead of it with uncertain impact on infection, severity, vaccine efficacy. So the market will have to deal with that as well. So we are, over the course of the next year, just ripe for monetary policy recalibration. And that can be a huge source of volatility. We saw a little bit of it last week with Powell in his testimony before Congress, kind of restriking the timeline for taper. And that's even before we get into the discussion of hiking. And that's going to raise the issue of how high policy rates will go and how quickly the Fed's going to need to get there. And that raises, as usual, anytime there's a hiking cycle, the policy that somehow the Fed overdoes it and tips the U.S. and larger parts of the global economy into recession. So if you look again at a little bit of history, as the Fed tapered the last time, volatility went up towards the end of tapering and remained much higher in 2015. It's a noisy episode. There was an energy crash at that point as well. But the vol markets don't seem to be concerned. Implied vol goes down. So I think that is clearly a trading opportunity, either to hedge some of the spread risk that you have that would come through higher vol, or to take advantage of higher vol outright through a variety of option strategies or other cash market strategies, which, you know, certainly we'd be happy to discuss. The second major point I just touch on for a minute is that we are still likely to be looking at low and potentially even lower risk-adjusted returns going forward and a flatter spread curve. The market is still just awash in cash. Taper, even through taper, we're going to see more of it from the Fed, other central banks as well. And the process of renormalizing the Fed's balance sheet is really a multi-year process that's likely to stretch well beyond 2024. And even then, once the Fed finishes its renormalization, in the banking system, both the U.S. and other central banks are likely to leave a lot more liquidity in the banking system, which is going to be a persistent source of downward pressure on risk-adjusted returns. We see it. The market is priced for some of that already. Treasury term premiums, super, super low. In fact, they're negative. In the mortgage market, spreads are low. In the investment grade and high yield corporate markets, the spread curve has flattened as well. So lots of cash likely to keep risk-adjusted returns historically low going forward. There are other points that are worth talking about that I'll leave for another time, including the fact, maybe surprising to some, that inflation historically has actually been good for credit fundamentals, at least in the U.S., where corporate revenues tend to move up faster with inflation than corporate costs. We're certainly looking at historically good corporate profits in the U.S. and corporate margins. We think there's going to be a continuing strong market in private credit because bank lending is going to remain tentative and constrained. And we think there are going to be some issues, very niche issues, with SOFR, increased emphasis on climate, especially around the capital that various regulated investment portfolios will hold, and some issues around crypto, especially as it affects the banking system and its source of funds. But we'll leave those detailed discussions for another time. So those are the highlights of the macro outlook, and I'll hand it back to Siobhan.
Thanks so much, Steve. To further discussion on the year of potential volatility, I'll shift now to Stephen Stanley, who is our U.S. chief economist, to discuss the Fed and his view for the economy, U.S. economy this year. Stephen, if you could please go forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Siobhan, and thank you all for dialing in. Yeah, I'll talk for just a few minutes on the outlook for the economy and, in particular, some of the potential surprises that we might see over the course of the year. So it, just as a preface, the consensus view heading into 2022 looks something like this. U.S. real GDP growth slowing down something like 4% in the first half of the year and down to around 3% in the second half, so slowly gliding toward a more sustainable pace. The unemployment rate dropping over time, reaching 4% by the middle of the year and down into the high 3s by the end of the year. Inflation coming off dramatically. The consensus still has inflation coming down to around 2.5% by the end of next year, which, given where we are now and in particular where we're likely to be heading over the next couple of months, would be a very steep drop-off. And we know that financial market participants have in recent months begun to really more aggressively price in the Fed for next year. And at last look, we had certainly two and pretty close to three quarter point rate hikes from the Fed priced into Fed funds futures for the end of 2022. So my own view is probably a little more bullish than that on the economy. I think the U.S. economy is likely to continue growing well above trend. I suspect the unemployment rate will fall faster than what most people think. And unfortunately, I think the inflation numbers, while they are going to come off from the multi-decade highs that we're seemingly setting every month now, we're still probably going to be far above the Fed's 2% target as we move toward the end of this year, of next year, and into 2023. And so let me talk about a couple of specific risks that I see going forward. And the first one has to do with the economy overheating, and in particular on what's going to happen with all the supply bottlenecks that everyone is focused on right now. I think that one of the prevailing narratives in the economy is that the economy is just being plagued by a variety of supply bottlenecks that are being imposed because of the pandemic, and that once we kind of normalize the way people are able to move around and work and whatnot, that we'll just quickly get back to normal and the economy will be in balance. And I think there are instances where that is true. One example I would give would be the auto sector. We've seen auto production has been very specifically curtailed for much of 2020 and all of 2021 because of these chip shortages. And with chip plants starting to get back online and producing at a more normal pace, we're starting to finally see auto assemblies creeping higher. And eventually, hopefully, we'll get back to a normal pace of production, which should bring that market into better balance and hopefully give us a little bit of relief on the price front for motor vehicles. However, I could give you a different example, which I think is more indicative of what I think is kind of consistent with the risk that I have in mind here, which is, and I think in many cases, these imbalances are being caused not only by supply constraints, but also by extraordinarily robust demand. And I would throw out the port situation in the U.S. as an example of that. We know that the ports have been backed up. For months, you hear all the stories about ships that are just sitting in the ocean waiting for their turn to unload. We hear a lot of talk in the U.S. about a shortage of truck drivers to move the goods around the country once it finally is unloaded at the ports. And there are no doubt some supply constraints there involved, but really at the end of the day, it sounds like this is more than anything else a function of the fact that the volume of goods that we're trying to push through these ports is much higher than anything we've ever seen before, and we simply don't have the capacity to handle that amount of goods. And so I think my view is that consumer demand is going to remain elevated next year. You're still getting strong job gains and sharp wage hikes, so income should be growing fast on top of the fact that households in the aggregate have accumulated several trillion dollars in excess savings that they piled up during the pandemic. Business demand should also be propelled by robust profit growth, and business balance sheets are also in very good shape. So I think the prospects are good for very strong, unusually strong spending again in 2022. And as a result, I think what we're going to find, even as some of these supply bottlenecks start to unwind, is that at the end of the day, the demand is just too much for what the current production capacity is in the economy. I would make a similar case on the labor market front. We've seen lots and lots of stories about a worker shortage, and there was generally a view that the supply situation in the labor market would ease up a little bit in the fall as people started to flock back into the labor market with the expiration of extra unemployment benefits, with schools starting back and therefore freeing up parents to get back to work, and with presumably with more people getting vaccinated, health concerns potentially ebbing. And we've seen a little bit of that, but it certainly hasn't been as rapid or as substantial as thought. But certainly the last employment report that we got last Friday did show a big increase in labor force participation, and a lot of the surveys of businesses that economists track are also suggesting that while worker shortages remain acute, they're starting to, just at the margin, to loosen up just a little bit. But I think what we may find next year is that even if we get, say, 2 or 3 million extra people that move off the sidelines and back into the workforce, that we're probably still going to have a labor shortage. You look at the latest JOLTS reading from this week, which shows that job openings in the U.S. Running at 11 million. The pre-pandemic high was only 7.5 million. So, you know, again, there's so many job openings that even if we do get an increase in labor force participation, I think we're going to find that the economy is going to reach something approaching full employment, certainly in the full in the first half of 2022. And my guess is once we get there, that we're still going to find elevated demand for workers and a lot of jobs that are still remaining open, which of course means tight labor markets, rising wages, and an economy that just continues to overheat. And that, with that, I would turn quickly to inflation. As I mentioned, I think that we will get some relief on the inflation front, but unfortunately, given that the economy is going to continue to run hot, I wouldn't be surprised to see inflation late next year still running above 3%, which would be better than now, but still well above what the Fed targets. Finally, let me talk for a minute about the Fed and one risk that I see for 2022. So as I mentioned at the outset, the market expectations around the Fed have moved dramatically this year. If you go back to the beginning of the year, really there was still a pretty broad consensus that liftoff on rates was not going to take place until maybe 2024. And, of course, now, as I mentioned, we've got between 2 and 3 rate hikes priced in already before the end of 2022. So there's been a dramatic shift in expectations for the Fed in the near term. However, if you look further out at, you know, whether you look at Eurodollar futures or SOFR futures or other indicators of kind of monetary policy expectations in the market, what you find is that market participants still think that this is going to be a very abbreviated rate cycle relative to historical experience. So, you know, a peak rate of somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.5%. Now, the Fed itself pegs neutral at about 2.5. So, I think, in my view, with inflation continuing to run high, ultimately, and this may be, you know, several years out, but ultimately the Fed is probably going to have to move at least modestly into restrictive territory to tamp down inflation. In my view, the rate cycle is going to be a lot more extended than what is currently priced in. And I think this kind of longer run view about monetary policy is one that may very well be challenged in 2022, where people start to recognize, especially once the Fed starts to raise rates and if inflation doesn't respond forcefully right away, you know, people may start to think more about, okay, how far are they really going to have to go here, and start to think about maybe a higher terminal rate than what's currently priced in. And, of course, that has a lot of implications for the yield curve, for long-term treasury yields, and for a variety of other market indicators as well as for the economy over time. And with that, I will turn it back over to Siobhan.
Thank you so much, Stephen. So just a quick admin note, if you have any questions, you can post them at any point in the question chat box for either Steve or Stephen or myself, and we'll address them at the end of the presentation. So with Stephen's outlook for the U.S. economy and Steve's comment on potential volatility, it's certainly gearing up for a difficult moment for emerging markets. It's an early phase of liquidity unwind. We have potential for volatility and uncertainty. We had a preview of that in November, and also treasury risk. So I think in that context, LATAM sovereign high yielders will remain a focal point, not only for the carry, but I think it's also important that the focus is on careful risk selection, given their high beta status and the potential for higher generalized volatility. And the bottom line, I think, for the high yielders is it's all about idiosyncratic risk. So the top picks that I have for next year are the province of Buenos Aires, Ecuador, and the Bahamas. A few themes, though, to start for LATAM. I'm constructive generally across high yield. I don't have any underweights at the moment. This is a view based mostly on valuations. If you look at the high yielders, we are at or above distress levels. I think this really increases the risk for positive asymmetry. And for those where I'm still cautious, I would qualify myself as sort of nervous neutrals, mostly on El Salvador, but also sort of on Costa Rica. I go back and forth on that credit. In terms of an important theme across Latin America, it's still about IMF execution risks. We have political cycles in the region. We have recession fatigue after the shock from COVID. And the IMF relationship, I think, is difficult because given the election cycles and recession fatigue, then, you know, that may discourage fiscal discipline. We've seen pushbacks for tax hikes not only in Colombia but also Costa Rica. In terms of who are the countries, who are the haves and have-nots in terms of IMF programs, I think the market clearly has priced out any type of an IMF program for El Salvador, weak IMF programs in Costa Rica and Argentina, and I would qualify Ecuador as the one credit with a strong IMF program. I also want to have a little bit of a disclaimer here that it is a year of fluid event risk. These are credits that have unstable equilibriums, so it's difficult to commit to a 12-month horizon. If I reference last year, I went into last year with El Salvador being my high conviction overweight. It was a top performer through the first half of 2001, but after the Bukele risk premium, I shifted to underweight at the end of September. That was a little bit earlier than I should have given the price move in November. But El Salvador is now finishing this year as the worst performer, down 25.5% on the Bloomberg Ag. So it is, I think, important to closely monitor idiosyncratic risk and amongst the high yielders. So in terms of my top picks, Argentina, I'll start with, that's just a quick overview for LATAM strategy, and you can see on this chart here the rising treasury risk premium and the difficulty in terms of EM performers, very few top performers so far this year. So starting with Argentina, I think it's critical. The midterm elections is no doubt about it. That was such an important turning point on policy management, both near-term and midterm. And there is no alternative to an IMF program. If you look at local markets in Argentina, the current crisis of confidence on the exchange rate, intense cash flow stress, especially heading into year-end seasonals, and they have a negative stock of dollar liquidity if you look at net liquid FX reserves. So we are still at extremes here. That in itself is the catalyst to reach an agreement with the IMF. I think the deal risk is very low. In terms of the policy shift in Argentina, I would qualify it as only a slow shift. It's going to return back to gradualism without the COVID distortions and stress. It's not going to be shock therapy, obviously, under still the influence of Kirchnerismo within the Fernandez government. When we look at Argentina, it's been two lost years, still a structural high, a fiscal deficit, structurally high inflation, a burdened indebted central bank, and also a return to a higher subsidy burden. So clearly there's a lot of wood to chop in Argentina. I would see Argentina as a country that is bottoming in terms of policy heterodoxy and macro imbalances, but it's only a slow return towards debt sustainability. In terms of asset prices, I still think that the IMF program, the negotiations, board approval, all of that process will still get us back to the high end of the price range back in September or the fourth quarter of 2020. So that's still about a 10% rally from the rally that we've had off the lows. So I think that's, in a near-term view, still good news for Argentina. But I think for Argentina, you have to take a more of a medium-term view, and the priority here is on coupons and current yield. So if you look at the 38s and the 41s, the 41 current yield isn't so bad, but where I prefer and have, you know, at least for the past 6 months, has been the province of BA. You get still a very high current yield of 9%. We've had a bounce off the lows. I still think cash prices and yields are too low here. It trades as a spread product to the sovereign, so you have the same optionality to the upside, but you get paid to wait, right? You get paid for that slow transition. So I think the province of BA is really a much better alternative than the sovereign. in terms of that legacy, you know, distressed pricing that we'll see for the sovereign, that will be an overhang for the province of BA, but I view it more as a distortion because if you look at the separate fundamentals, with the setback in 2 years for the sovereign, yes, the high default risk will remain on asset prices, but for the quasi-sovereigns and the corporates, they don't deficit finance, they don't have as much leverage as the sovereign. I don't think you have that same default risk for the provinces, including the province of BA. So I think it's much better fundamentals and much better optionality in terms of default risk going forward. So that's something to focus on in terms of relative value. Switching next to Ecuador. Ecuador is, I think, very much underappreciated. I sent out a report today on Ecuador in terms of the bounce we've had, but when I look at yields, yes, we're off the worst levels of 10%, you know, getting, you know, 9.5%, but we're very far from the yield lows that we saw in September. And when I think about Ecuador, if anyone had the inconvenience of following the tax reform approval a couple of Fridays ago, it was painful. But what I think was interesting was when all looked lost, President Lasso really pulled out a win here, and maybe some behind-closed-doors agreement with the Correistas, he was able to get tax reform through. And what I think the market underappreciates is the political acumen of President Lasso to get things done. Now, we know Ecuador's track record. We've all been disappointed in the past with Ecuador's policy management. Even Moreno has had policy mistakes, but if you isolate and look at the successes that Lasso has had, it's really quite incredible. I know that the positioning might be a concern or thinned year-end liquidity, you know, waiting for, you know, more capital, better capital commitment in January. Or maybe it's this feeling that, oh, well, whatever success he had, it could be challenged, it could be unwound. We've seen that obviously in the past for Ecuador. But I want to focus on a couple developments that we've seen over the past couple of weeks. Firstly, Kone a few months ago threatened to take to the streets. They did. After 2 days of protests without effect, you know, they came back to the negotiating table. And they basically drew down their leverage and not much else they can do at this point to take an activist stance and really push their agenda. So they're forced to be more reasonable and negotiate going forward. I think that was a big success that was overlooked by the markets and current pricing. Also, the backroom deal with the Correistas shows the ability to negotiate where he can with the Assembly. And the tax reform needed to go through the Assembly, but the other reform agenda doesn't necessarily need to go through the Assembly. There are other alternatives for President Lasso. And the important thing, too, is with the tax reform, it was really an umbrella reform agenda. The obvious implications are higher the revenue. It was approved in its original version, so we're going to get even more than expected revenue for the budget for 2022. Oil prices are higher. Plus, we have there was basically, with the tax reform, there was kind of some hidden oil reforms that were embedded within the umbrella tax reform, and that will also basically shifting service agreements to production sharing agreements, private sector concessions and exploration, exploitation of oil, delegation of public fields to the private sector. That's going to help push the reform agenda. So I think with Ecuador, there is really some momentum here in reform that is underestimated by these current yields, and I have confidence moving forward that Lasso, if he can maintain his popularity, benefit from the cyclical recovery, will have strong IMF relations through next year, strong fiscal performance. And the bottom line is Ecuador is one of the few, if only, country in LATAM that is approving tax reform and that will have a structural shift on the fiscal deficit by 3% of GDP going into next year, and basically will push the balance sheet back to even better than pre-COVID levels. And effectively, that's the recipe that Latin America needs to tackle the higher debt levels after the COVID shock. So, I mean, that progress, I think, is meaningful and would merit yields closer to 8% than 10%. So Ecuador remains one of my top picks. Moving on to the Bahamas. Bahamas I view more as kind of a high-carry, muddle-through story. Last year, my top pick for high-yield carry returns was Uruguay Linkers. Didn't disappoint with 13% FX-adjusted returns on the UI 28s through November. This year, it's the Bahamas in terms of carry. I don't see the payments as threatening in terms of Eurobond payments. Coupons are quite small at 2% of GDP. The overall debt service for the budget is quite manageable. We're 25 months ahead of the next amortization payment in the Bahamas. There is a bit of, I think, still some legacy supply risk premium on the long-end tenors, but they've clearly announced that their funding strategy is diverted towards multilaterals and local funding. So I think some of that supply risk premium should start to fade, and the curve should benefit from some bullish steepening. But I look really at the Bahamas as kind of a muddle through. The pros are a strong willingness to pay, strong track record of debt repayment. When you speak with the officials, they'll tell you debt repayment and debt is sacrosanct. The cons is, with still high unemployment, it's small open economy, tourism-based, clearly vulnerable to external trends, and it's a slow shift, right? There's not going to be a huge commitment to the negative shock of fiscal austerity. It's going to be a small turn. But with a smaller country, with smaller gross funding needs, I do think it's manageable in the near term. And in the next year, next fiscal year, I would say in the two next fiscal years, those gross funding needs will be much lower. So a muddle-through strategy, I think, is realistic for this credit. And you're looking at still 9% yields. So Bahamas is one of my top picks. In terms of the nervous neutrals, beginning with Costa Rica here, I think I'm less nervous on Costa Rica. We thankfully finally got another first-round vote on the public employment bill. It's heading to the Constitutional Court. Unfortunately, we're getting delayed into next year. Because of that and no progress on the tax hikes, it is a weaker IMF program, but remember, this is a normal access program. So even if the IMF delays disbursement, which they have, we haven't had clarity or closure on their end September, early October program review and no schedule yet for a board meeting. I think the market still recognizes that there is progress here. The fiscal performance, economic growth, the Moody's outlook revision to neutral really validates here that there has been positive change, right? So even if that does not disperse normal access funding from the IMF, I still think that Costa Rica will have full access to their own local markets, and that's actually, I think, the crux of support here for Costa Rica. Going forward, they have an election cycle that's very relevant, obviously. The major candidates, I do think, support the IMF program. They're not going to endorse tax hikes in an election cycle, maybe less so afterwards. But if there is a reluctance to push forward some of these progressive tax hikes, then clearly the next administration has to support the public employment bill. And we've seen broader support. So when the election cycle is over, we make a transition. Any incoming administration will want to own their IMF program. There is potential for revisions, but not really much flexibility. This is a gradual backloaded program, and the crux of it really is the public employment bill. In terms of the public employment bill, when this does get done, it's unfortunately later as opposed to sooner. I think it's important to emphasize that Costa Rica is a rules-based country, and being a rules-based country, like we've seen with the fiscal rule, there is emphasis on compliance. So we typically do see strong compliance. The public employment reform, the fiscal rule, I think could be that shift of getting that medium-term stability on the fiscal accounts. So I do think that lays that critical groundwork for a structural shift for Costa Rica. And there will be clearly some noise with the election cycle. But keep in mind, if you look at the CoStar Domrep differential on the 45-49s, we're back up to the worst levels. It's been a pretty tight range this year of 90 to 150 basis point Z-spread differential. We're back to the wides. Do we need wider premium if we kind of reference the levels that we saw in 2020, in spring of 2020 and summer of 2020, like a 150-200? It seems to me maybe a bit excessive. I do think that any incoming administration will resume the IMF program, maybe with some slight revisions. But this was an IMF program that was socially negotiated across a political spectrum. The current government is center-left across the various sectors of society. It's a progressive program. It's a gradual program. And it's a necessary program. If they want to fund a slow transition, they need the positive vote of confidence from an IMF program. So I don't see Costa Rica kind of falling out, right, in terms of a negative shock there. I think it's kind of a slow grind. And, again, we're kind of at the worst levels versus, you know, the double B, single B peers. Shifting now to El Salvador, this is definitely still a nervous neutral. The long end we're pricing, you know, around 60, the front end just above 80 on the 2023s. When I look at El Salvador, I definitely see it as binary. It's either muddle through without the IMF or default. I think the prices are kind of fair. We've already priced in a lot of risk here. One of the potential risk scenarios, if you look at a 60 cash price, as I would qualify it, is a high probability of defaults with a low recovery value, but maybe a couple of years of coupon payments. And that's what I'm kind of thinking how El Salvador can develop here, where it could be the pain trade and kind of reminds me of PDVSA, where it is a small country, small gross financing needs. So, you know, muddling through for longer is possible. When you look at the November reserves that was just released, they still haven't spent their $400 million IMF SDR. They still have deposits at the central bank. They're trying to solidify their membership with CAF. That could maybe release some funds. I think the Bitcoin bond launch in January will be critical to see if that allows an alternative source of liquidity. So that's going to be very important to monitor. But, you know, kind of muddling through this year and next year, you know, for me, when I look at the sources and uses, I could probably easily identify enough sources for this year and next year, especially if they shift towards more financial coercion or financial repression in the local markets. But I think what's more important is, can you have comfort around the willingness to pay? And this is a country that does not have a history of default, if you kind of exclude the accidental pension fund default in 2017 on the local pension liability. But this is not a country that has checks and balances. So effectively, the willingness to pay really focuses on President Bukele himself. What I think is interesting are some recent developments where there was collaboration and publication of the IMF Article 4, so kind of showing the importance of legitimacy and maybe even a Plan B, you know, having that as an option, knowing that you still have normalized relations with the IMF. There's also been a reluctance to nationalize the pension funds. This is, you know, the pension fund reform and speculation about nationalizing the pension funds, that's been kind of in the headlines and under discussion for months, but there's been a reluctance to do that, and maybe it's because there's an effort to fund externally. If El Salvador wants to fund externally, then it kind of forces more rational policy management, and if they're issuing Bitcoin-related bonds, then you're probably going to have to honor the financial contract for your bonds as well. So that gives me a little bit area of comfort. I don't know if I'm aggressive enough to outright recommend the 2023, and it'll probably be a mistake when it gets pulled apart to payment in January of next year, of 2023. But I do think that this could be kind of a slow play in terms of a muddling through. Where I have less comfort is medium-term debt sustainability. This is a country with high debt ratios, poor fiscal performance, if you look at the budget this year and make it more realistic, kind of no improvement versus 2021 and still far from pre-COVID levels in 2019. So we haven't really seen the shift in terms of the fiscal accounts. And this is a strategy that's still focused on a public investment growth strategy. And it really needs to shift to a private investment growth strategy. And for that to happen, he needs to really encourage inflows of foreign direct investment and private capital. And I don't know if that's possible with how tense the diplomatic relations are with the U.S., the uncertainty of the medium-term plan, the weak credit ratings for this country, and really no understanding what the sustainable long-term plan is. So that does make me very nervous about, you know, 2, 3, 4 years out. But I do think that this could be a muddle through for longer and kind of be a pain train in terms of focusing on carry, but still very much aware that debt sustainability will remain an overhang and will remain a concern. So why don't I stop there, because I've basically gone through all the credits, but more than happy to take some questions if anyone wants to post them in the chat. So let me look at what we have here. One question that I have is, could El Salvador spend from international reserves to pay the Eurobond in 2023? When you look at the reserve position in El Salvador, and I've done this analysis for Ecuador and dollarized countries, it is not weak dollarization, but when I look at reserves, it's just basically the depository between inflows and outflows on the balance of payments account. It is not a stock of assets. There are not excess reserves. And the only portion of reserves for being an independent central bank that the Treasury could access are their deposits at the central bank. And that's the latest numbers we have. They're only around $600 million. So could they change the rules? Could they compromise the integrity and independence of the central bank at some point if they are desperate to forcibly acquire assets? Possibly, but are there enough assets? You know, no. I mean, a portion of reserves, the majority of the reserves, are allocated for the private sector bank deposits. So those are claims that cannot be accessed. And, you know, if there are any residual reserves beyond the claims from public sector, the private sector, if you start basically, you know, making a claim on those and compromising the integrity of the central bank, you may compromise the integrity of dollarization itself. So that would be the beginning to the end game if that were the strategy, and I certainly don't see that as Plan B. Plan B, I don't completely disregard that they might go to the IMF, though that doesn't really sound like Bukele's style. Plan B seems to be to first rely upon locals as lenders of last resort. So I would assume that would be the first Plan B and not the central bank reserve assets. Do we have any other questions, reminder to question, and also questions for if anyone wants to post questions for Steve or Stephen on U.S. markets or the U.S. economy, then please also add those questions there as well. So another question coming in. The IMF has been very flexible with Ecuador, Costa Rica, and Honduras this year. Do you expect them to remain very flexible in 2022 or to become more stringent in terms of their requirements? This would be relevant specifically for Ecuador and Costa Rica going forward, but especially Costa Rica. So, yes, this is very relevant. The IMF has been flexible. We've seen all the headlines, right, with the IMF SDR allocations, sort of weaker programs, programs that are growth-oriented, that are growth, socially inclusive growth. Ecuador, I would qualify as the poster child, as a success for the IMF, and I would disregard there was an article and some comments today that a current disbursement is at risk. I completely disregard that view. I think that the IMF-Ecuador relationship is very strong. In terms of Ecuador, they basically, with tax reform, complied with the only important structural benchmark that requires legislative cooperation. So the rest of the structural benchmarks are under directive of the executive and then easier to comply with, you know, lower execution risk. In terms of the main targets, it really focuses on the fiscal performance as a performance criteria. And I think with still high oil prices, economic recovery, tax reform, I would say they have the lowest execution risk, so it wouldn't require any IMF flexibility. With Costa Rica, it tends to get a bit tricky. We are sort of in limbo with the IMF in Costa Rica in terms of the fund disbursement and closing the last review. I think the IMF has a very difficult decision. There's pros and cons. They've more than delivered on the fiscal performance, which is great, but the structural performance criteria and the public employment bill is very important because we almost need those extra savings to compensate for the forfeited tax reform that did not get done this year. And even if they get tax reform done next year, it wouldn't count until the following year. So public employment reform is really important. I also think the IMF might be conflicted because if they approve the next disbursement, does that demotivate the Assembly to get public employment reform and the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court, actually, as well, to finalize this reform? So I think they'll, you know, I almost think they'll be silent and not qualify their relationship in any way, although they will be asked questions at press conferences, but try to, you know, say, listen, there's been, you know, encouraging, you know, fiscal performance, we're waiting for this, waiting for that, and basically say, you know, we're waiting, and not indicate any suspension of the program, but just say we're waiting till we see what happens on the public employment reform. So I don't think there will be a disbursement, but the public employment reform will be critical, and I think the Costa Ricans realize that they need that vote of confidence, right? They need that enforcement mechanism to force these compliant or complacent, I should say complacent, not compliant, complacent deputies to push these reforms through. So, I kind of think that formula will kind of continue going into next year. So I don't think it's going to be a suspension of the program, but I think the IMF will make it clear that they need that public employment reform done in order to make the next disbursement. So I think we will remain in limbo until next year for Costa Rica. So the next question I have is, can Nayib Bukele be planning to issue a new currency and looking for de-dollarization of El Salvador? Yeah, de-dollarization. I do think he is trying to de-dollarize with Bitcoin. But Bitcoin is, what, 1% of the transactions in the country, so it's not going to replace dollarization. I haven't really seen an orderly exit of dollarization anywhere. Argentina tried it in 2001 when they brought back Cavallo, and he tried to introduce a basket of currencies instead of the dollar, the one-to-one dollar peso peg, and that didn't work. And then it was a really disorderly exit of dollarization. I think it's very difficult to exit dollarization once it's become a complete part, an integral part of the economy as it has been. In El Salvador, it's a small open economy. It's dependent upon the dollar and dollar flows. And Bitcoin, you know, I think, you know, President Bukele would like to de-dollarize and shift to Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is no substitute with its high volatility. It is no substitute for the dollar. So, that could be his grandiose plans, but it's not at all realistic in the near term. He is definitely stuck with the dollar, and if there is an exit, it will be disorderly. We have one more question here. Could LATAM countries use SDR allocations from the IMF to pay debt like Mexico did with Pemex? Yeah, and Argentina did with the IMF loans. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if it's possible in El Salvador. I think they have to change some regulations. Ecuador was able to find a way to use those funds for budget support. The IMF is encouraging countries to use those SDRs as budget support. So it really depends upon the domestic regulatory environment, but most countries have found a way to use the SDRs. That includes Ecuador, Argentina, as you say, Mexico. So that is the common trend. It's seen as a windfall to help out. And I assume that if countries can find a way to use that claim, they most certainly will, and especially if they need to, which are the weaker countries. Any other questions? We're getting close to the top of the hour. Any questions on the U.S.? No? Okay, so why don't I stop there? I thank you, everyone, for joining, and sorry for the late start, but you can reach out to me or Steve or Stephen directly via email if you'd like to have any follow-up questions. And also, I would encourage everyone to read the Year Ahead reports. There's a lot more detail there. And I thank you, everyone, for your time today and your attendance. Thank you so much. Have a great day.